name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. Hello and welcome to Peer Home with me, Sarhakju. Well, we all know that family is the core of society, and that bond or that glue that keeps family together is attachment. Attachment and the psychology of attachment and its implications for family members is the topic of discussion in today's program. Of course, we have other segments to our program. We have From Here and There, a report, and much, much more. So stay with us for the next 45 minutes. Back to the program. Well, we are honored to have Dr. Sayed Mohsen Fatemi with us to discuss the psychology of attachment and its implications for family members. Just a reminder, Dr. Fatemi has done his postdoctoral studies in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. He teaches in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University, the University of Massachusetts in Boston, Western Washington University, and a number of other universities. Dr. Fatemi is a registered psychologist and a keynote speaker at a number of international congresses, as well as a published author. He's also part of the advisory and editorial board of the American Psychological Association Encyclopedia of Critical Psychology. Hello, and a very warm welcome back to the program,
Thank
Dr.
you.
Fatemi. I guess we could get straight to the topic, and what we want to know is, what is the attachment, what is attachment altogether, and how does it affect the relationship among family members?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To begin with, in terms of definition of attachment, we need to understand how attachment unfolds itself among family members. You probably acknowledge that when you talk about any communication, communication is affecting and being affected by people around yourself. So when you talk about attachment is the type of bond that you establish between you and people around yourself. Attachment goes back to the earliest stages of life when infants experience insecurity, failure, skepticism, doubts, and lack of safety. The caregivers that are going to have some sort of connectedness to the infants develop different forms of attachment styles. And the studies by Ainsworth and a number of other scholars have demonstrated that we basically have three types of attachment styles that are going to have implications for further relationship in life. So the type of attachments that you establish between you and the caregivers are going to have an influence on how you're going to establish your relationship in a long-standing form of relationship for your nuptial relations, for your marriage, for your dating relationship, romantic sort of ties as well.
So, I mean, personally, how I would establish a relationship with my mother would go on to show how I would establish a relationship with my spouse in the future?
Yeah, in the future. So, the caregivers that we are exposed to can come up with three different styles, or we are going to experience three different types of styles of attachments. One is a secure attachment style when the infants are going to experience comfort and security and tranquility and composure. They trust the caregivers. There is no perturbability in terms of communication. They can have this trust further down the road towards the person that they're going
healthy.
To, you know, it's a sort of healthy relationship. So it's filled with trust, understanding, you know, amicable form of relationship. The second one is called the avoidant attachment style, that you experience rebuffing attempts. You experience remonstration, you experience rejection, turning down approach. And as a result of that, you want to be close to people around yourself, you want to be intimate, but you sort of avoid because you have this sort of doubt deep down yourself that what if they reject you or what if they just say no or something.
Because you have been rejected to begin with.
Because you have been rejected or you have received responses that are going to be affiliated with a sort of rebuffing attempts or something, so you have not experienced that sort of warmth or affection or something. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, you don't experience that sense of preparation, flexibility towards people around yourself, because you have not seen people around you as caregivers sensitive and responsive towards your needs. Mm-hmm. So your needs have been ignored, your needs have been marginalized, your needs have been discounted, and as a result of that, people are not going to experience that sense of comfort because of the so-called insecurity that they have experienced.
But this person doesn't tend to ostracize themselves. They still want to seek that kind of warmth.
Yeah, they want to do it, but they have this sort of avoidance because they're not sure. You know, the experience that pops in their minds is that, well, I wanted to be close. I wanted to experience that sort of intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. But in return, I receive nothing except a blow or something against what I wanted to go ahead with. The third type of attachment style is called anxious, ambivalent attachment style, that people are going to, again, experience that sense of insecurity because they're not sure if they are going to receive the type of welcoming approach on behalf of caregivers, because the caregivers are sort of condescending sometimes, overbearing some, so they have this inconsistent pattern in terms of the caregivers. The caregivers do not provide them with that sense of, you know, comfort. I'm going to be protecting you, I'm going to be caring, you know, I'm going to be concerned about your feelings and emotions or something. So the response that they get from the caregivers is associated with not only perturbability and insecurity, but also an inconsistent pattern that they haven't got that sense of, well, he's available, she's available, I can always have that sense of availability. So availability, responsiveness, flexibility, sensitivity are all up in the air. And as a result of that, they experience that sense of, anxious, ambivalent styles. The research demonstrates that when people experience any of these attachment styles, mm-hmm. this has implications mm-hmm. for the relationship down the road. So if they experience, for example, comfort, security, understanding, and warmth, they would have that sense of trust. And if they experience avoidance, fear, exasperation, and frustration, and insecurity, they would always have some sort of fear. They can't get intimate. Mm-hmm. They want to get close and intimate, but they always have this fear of rejection. What if she turns me down? What if he turns me down? And also this feeling of anxiety, butterflies in the stomach, always pops up because they don't have that sense of assurance that I can approach, but I would have that sense of comfort. They have this volcanic explosion of anxiety always because of the experiences that they have.
Which is worse, the second one or the third one? Which one is worse, the second one or the third one?
Well, the second one and the third one both have negative and deleterious complications and implications. So it's not a matter of, some studies, for example, demonstrated that when they wanted to run this in a lab setting, mm-hmm. they had people, for example, who were just have some sort of dating relationship, and they ask one to be speaking about something and then the other one to be waiting in the waiting room and mm-hmm. to listen to that person. And they first ask him to do a questionnaire in terms of attachment style so that they know what attachment styles they're going to be affiliated to. Once they did that, they just mm-hmm. randomly assigned these people and they said, okay, your partner is going to have a presentation on let's say college education, and then you're going to come up with some responses. But they did not tell the people that these responses are already, in terms of feedbacks, have been prepared. So they had these feedback prepared mm-hmm. in advance by the researchers to these people who were waiting for their couples or something. Mm-hmm. And the responses, two of them were positive, were comments, ovation, you did a good job, everything was great, I'm proud of you. The second comments were somehow filled with some sort of negativity, you did a good job, but just be careful to say something, appropriate, because if you say something inappropriate, it's going to be embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Or the other comment was like, you did a good job overall, but I was just sort of, hoping that you could have covered, for example, so and so. And these feedbacks were given to people, mm-hmm. their partners who were just speaking. Those who came from, secure attachment styles, mm-hmm. they said, well, this is just a perspective, a mm-hmm. neutral sort of perspective. Those who came from anxious attachment style or the avoidant attachment styles, they got really upset and they said, well, something is wrong, and they got furious mm-hmm. and they were about to fly off the handle or something because of the previous experiences that they had. This, however, does not mean that you're going to be doomed by your attachment styles and there would be no possibility of revamping your relationship or something. And as a result of that, you're going to just go ahead with the same sort of things that people have given you.
Good.
On the contrary, this suggests that we can always revamp and revise if we are exposed to the right coaching, right form of counseling, right form of educational, pedagogical programs. And in the meantime, studies demonstrated that those who were exposed to some sort of appropriate programs, they demonstrated a high percentage, up to 25 to 35% of development and improvement in forms of relationship.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay, so obviously we want to go into this topic a little bit more, but we'll go listen to our story and of course we'll be back.
Once upon a time, the Caliph of Baghdad woke up after the midnight. He had a nightmare which had filled him with fear. In the morning, when the minister went to go see the Caliph, he found him tired and sleepy. He asked, "What has happened that I see you so tired and worried?" The Caliph rubbed his eyes and said, "I had a nightmare last night which made me sleepless until morning." The minister said, "Don't worry, maybe it has a good interpretation. In order to calm down, we'll invite two dream interpreters so that they can interpret your dream." The Caliph's men went and brought two dream interpreters to the court. The first one said, "Long live the Caliph. Please tell me your dream from the beginning to the end. Don't add or omit any details." The Caliph, who was still worried, said, "I dreamt that all my teeth fell out suddenly." The first dream interpreter said, "Your dream means that all your relatives will die and you will survive." Hearing this, the Caliph hit himself on the head and said, "Shame on you. What the hell are you saying? Punish this man as soon as possible." Then he looked at the second dream interpreter and said, "It's your turn now. Interpret my last night's dream." The second dream interpreter looked at the Caliph calmly and said, "Long live the Caliph. I have good news for you. Your teeth falling down means that you will live longer than all of your relatives." Hearing the words of the second dream interpreter, the Caliph smiled calmly and said, "Good job. Give him a reward. He made me very happy." One of the courtiers asked the minister, "Both of the dream interpreters said the same thing. Why was one of them punished and the other rewarded?" The minister answered, "Both of them said the same thing, but you can say the same thing in different ways. One of them said it badly and was punished. The other one said it beautifully and was rewarded."
Welcome back. Well, we're here with Dr. Said Mohsen Fatemi, and we're discussing the psychology of attachment and its implications amongst family members. And before the break, we talked about the three different styles of attachment. And we talked about something during the break. I thought it might be helpful for the audience also. The second type and the third type, we talked about avoidance and then the anxious and ambivalent. And I thought with the last type, what I wanted to know is that a child, is that a a relationship where we see a parent that is sometimes offering comfort and love, and at the same time sometimes loses their cool and is really angry? Is that what we're looking at there?
Yeah, it's almost in the same sort of line.
Because
in other words, you've got an inconsistent pattern.
Mm-hmm.
You see, in a healthy relationship, it's always important to have that sense of congruity and conformity. So, for example, when a mom holds her son or something, if she confirms that through her nonverbal communication, or she might hold, for example, him, but in the meantime, she might demonstrate some grudge or some anger or something.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you demonstrate that sort of sort of conformity,
mm-hmm.
sort of congruent approach, would have an impact on a healthy or unhealthy relationship. In unhealthy relationship, people have got double bind messages, mixed messages. So you say something, you show something else. It's like you talk about hope, for example, your facial expression demonstrates despondency, despair. You talk about comfort, your gesture and posture demonstrates perturbability and anxiety. You tell people, for example, welcome to my house, but in the meantime, your nonverbal communication suggests that I want you to be out of here as soon as possible. So it's just a matter of, you know, contradiction
mm-hmm.
between what you say and what you do. So in the anxious form, people have got this experience of sometimes they receive, sometimes on the other hand they came across this overbearing attitude, and that overbearing attitude has implications in a destructive sense. So they do not get that sense of comfort, that sense of composure that I can trust or I can rely. Bear in mind that when infants experience the world,
mm-hmm.
they have primary skills, and the primary skills is that they can elicit and maintain the attention through crying.
Mm-hmm.
They have a variety of forms of crying to demonstrate they're in distress or something.
Mm-hmm.
So listening to these demonstrations of crying forms, you know, parents are going to demonstrate responsiveness, flexibility, sensitivity or something. If they're not sensitive, if they're not flexible, if they're not getting that sense of attention that they should, the child feels ignored, discounted, marginalized, put down, sold
short. They have no other way of communication
And then as a result of that, they cannot experience safety. So the child is going to experience safety through the attachment that you establish. If the child cannot receive that sense of responsive approach on behalf of the parents, he or she is going to be discombobulated, wondering around what is happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, that world of insecurity is going to be associated with his or her mental world, and it has impacts on the future
mm-hmm.
types of relationships.
Hence the anxiousness.
Yeah.
I guess if you're sending mixed signals, like you said, or that sense of ignoring them, then obviously they would go on to feel mistrust and anxious. Okay, so let's move on in that. What's the role of intersubjectivity in describing the role of attachment?
Yeah, when we talk about intersubjectivity, which is a term in the psychology of attachments, we talk about when parents and children are experiencing moments that they are in sync with one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are cognitively and effectively on the same page. They experience the world not only from the cognitive, but also from the affective perspective, you know, from the same sort of presence. They are experiencing that presence. So if a child, for example, experiences something cognitively, and the parent demonstrates that sort of cognition, they have that presence.
Regardless
of age. And that is something incumbent upon the parents, specifically in the primordial stages of life, in the primary stages of life, when children are experiencing that sort of presence-oriented format on behalf of parents, they experience that sense of shared experience, you know.
Can you give us an example? Because I would think, I mean, for a child to experience one thing, it would be completely different for the parent. So how can they be in sync at that point?
Well, they could be in sync. For example, when you talk about an object or an event and the child cries and the mom, for example, pays no attention.
Mm-hmm.
Or the child, for example, is demonstrating this sense of ovation, this sense of admiration, this sense of I want this object,
mm-hmm.
and the mom is going to ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of the contradiction. Whereas the mom can comprehensively and quintessentially share that experience of shared want, shared feelings, because the child obviously has got feelings, has got needs and wants and desires. The question is that, are you going to demonstrate that sense of shared experience in terms of, I understand how you feel, I understand how you need, I understand what you need, I understand your desires, and I am present when you are, you know, attuned to those sort of things. So in terms of affect, in terms of cognition, in terms of emotional components, when the child and the parents are cognitively and affectively experiencing that presence, they are experiencing intersubjectivity. Intersubjectivity consists of moments of demonstration of a shared experience, where you have the same sort of co-creation. You know, you co-create the meaning. You know, along with your child, you create the same sort of meaning that the child is creating. Because you as a mom experience the world of yourself, experience the world of the object, mm-hmm. and experience the world of the child, and experience the world of the experience of the child. Mm-hmm. And then demonstration of that experience is going to demonstrate
so many experiences.
a sense of exploration. And that exploration is quite important and significant. It's the sharing of vitality, you know, the vitality of affective components. When we talk about affect in psychology, which is a term different from feelings and emotions, mm-hmm. affect is a fundamental aspect of intersubjectivity. Because when you are in a sort of fundamental component of intersubjectivity, you experience the world along with somebody else based on the shared feelings, shared desires, shared wants. And as long as you have that sense of rapport and that sense of, you know, bridging the gap and creation of bonds or something, you would be demonstrating your attunement. You would be demonstrating your sensitivity and flexibility, and the child enjoys. Mm-hmm. Whereas you could demonstrate, well, I'm not in this world that you're experiencing, and as a result of that, I'm not experiencing the sense of presence. When we talk about this concept of presence between a child and a parent, we are focusing on intersubjectivity, that they are, in the meantime, at the same time, experience the same object, the same event, you know, through the presence. So if you and I talk about, for example, some toys in terms of cognition, and I'm not here, and you're talking about these toys in terms of cognition, and my cognition is about this flower, for example, this is not an example of intersubjectivity. Right. But if you talk about toys and the child, you know, demonstrate the same sort of interest, and you demonstrate the same sort of attention, it's going to be demonstration of intersubjectivity. It's not just a matter of cognition, it could be the matter of affect, so that you can cognitively and affectively involve yourself through that presence. So a child, for example, experiences some emotional component, whether it's rage or anger or happiness or something, and you would develop that sense of, I'm here with you, I'm present, and I understand, so I'm paying attention to your presence, and as a result of that presence, you and I co-create meanings together. We collaborate and cooperate. It's like you and I are demonstrating this creation through our own act of togetherness. And that sense of togetherness has great significant implications for the child, because she or he does not see himself or herself isolated mm-hmm. or ostracized from the presence of the parents.
But I have to be honest, I think as a parent, it would be extremely hard, because if you're dealing with a child, let's say a two-year-old, if you're dealing with a child 20, well, not 24 hours because they're sleeping at some point, but during, let's say, the 16 hours or the 12 hours that the child is awake, you're constantly dealing with a child who has constant wants, constant interests, constant upsetness, fears, and so on and so forth, that you constantly have to, I think, you can't be distracted, because, you know, if a child is excited over a picture, you, like you said, if you want to be in sync, you have to get in there and get involved and show excitement. And then if the child is upset because she wants candy and she can't have candy, you have to express that, I understand that you want candy, from my takeaway yeah. from what you said is that I understand that right now you want candy, but, you know, now is not the time. Wouldn't it be hard, because you have to leave your adult world and constantly yeah. bring yourself down?
Yeah. Well, that's why it has significant implications for, mm-hmm. you know, your own relationship with mm-hmm. the child. And the moment you ignore, it's like mm-hmm. when a child cries, what type of responses mm-hmm. you can come up with? You could just, you know, hold the child. You could go, you know, towards the child. You could approach the child and demonstrate that sense of affection. Mm-hmm. Or you could just say, you know, mm-hmm. pipe down, you know, mm-hmm. shut up. Or you could just leave the room. You know, responses that you come up with have implications for your child. Mm-hmm. And we're not focusing on just one response, bear in mind. We're focusing on recursive patterns of response. I mean, if you just have, for example, one bad day, one tough mm-hmm. day, and as a result mm-hmm. of that, you're not able to demonstrate that sense of affection, that sense of warmth mm-hmm. or empathy, sympathy type of thing, that's going to be fine. But if it's going to turn out to be a pattern, a recursive mm-hmm. pattern, the child is going to be psychologically dysregulated always, mm-hmm. you know, and the child's mental image of the caregiver is going to be influenced by those specific moments of lack of attention. Mm-hmm. That's why from an Islamic perspective, from an Islamic educational perspective, you can see traditions from Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and other infallible imams mm-hmm. demonstrating and indicating and explicating that you need to profusely and opulently provide your kids with the ample, adequate forms of attachment, of attention, of nurturing forms of behavior. And demonstration of that should be in a tangible, concrete manner, because the problems are going to develop when children are not experiencing that safe world. You can see that when we go ahead with the attachment style's implications in real life situations. You can see, for example, playfulness as a part of that mm-hmm. sort of a strategy that you can come up with, because that playfulness is not going to happen if the child does not feel secure. How could you ever ask a child to be playful mm-hmm. when he or she is not getting that sense of, hey, here's everything safe, I can experience that safety or something. Mm-hmm. If she experiences that sense of perturbability, that sense of anxiety, that sense of pandemonium, how could she ever experience that sense of playfulness?
Right, she's in order for him to
experience that playfulness, you need to just provide him or her with that safe climatic condition that everything is going to be fine.
So it's not, how about the argument that if you, I mean, like you said, if the child is crying and at that point you think, well, you know, they'll be spoiled if you can constantly give them attention at the time that they're acting out, and with that, I mean, do they become spoiled if you give them too much attention, or
no,
is too much attention
giving
never
attention,
bad?
Yeah, this is something that we need to make sure that we don't get them mixed with other mm-hmm. concepts. Giving attention to a child does not necessarily suggest that you're going to provide him or her with all yes responses. Mm-hmm. I can pay attention to you, and you can say, well, I would like to have coffee, but if not, you know, if you don't have coffee now, if you've got tea here, for example, I can just say, well, thank you for sharing your feelings and your desire or something, but well, we haven't got coffee here, we just have got tea right now. Mm-hmm. So paying attention to the desires, needs, and wants of a child does not necessarily suggest that you're going to develop that sense of yes response always. Mm-hmm. But there are two different things that we have to make, you know, distinguished from one another. It's just a matter of, are you going to ignore the child, or are you going to pay attention to the child, or are you going to pay attention to the child and necessarily come up with, well, you want a candy, here is a candy. You want a car, here's a car. You want a moon, I'm going to bring you the moonlight. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that we are going to provide the child necessarily with that sense of a yes response, regardless of the situation. I'm just saying that the propensity, the sense of flexibility, that responsiveness is of great significance mm-hmm. for a child, because he understands the caregiver is not going to ignore, mm-hmm. is not going to put him down, is not going to sell him short. And that is the psychological mechanism, the dynamics of that sense of openness that you develop. And that is going to have an impact on the mental image of the child, because the child's schema of relationship is going to be developed through all these recursive patterns. Mm-hmm. If every day you wake up and come up with this sense of attention, the child is going to be behaving the world in a different manner.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Of course, we want to talk a little bit more about the different attachment styles and if we can revise them or not. We'll take a break. When we come back, it's time for From Here and There. Welcome Welcome back. Well, in this part of the program, my colleague Farhad Bafoju will introduce an interesting book. Of course, he'll have an informative article and a lovely email from you, our dear viewers. So take it away, Mr. Bafoju.
Thank you very much, Ms. Arju.
You're very welcome.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this edition of From Here and There. Two Iranian scholars have been named as winners of the 2013 edition of Germany's Green Talents Award. Ali Kharrazi and Tayyebeh Zinati Shoa are among the 25 winners announced in this year's list. Kharrazi, PhD in sustainability science, has built up an impressive academic track record, moving from economics to sustainability. Zinati Shoa, studying MA, Water Resource Engineering, also made efforts to improve and help to further sustainability in an often overlooked but important sector, water resource management. The designated Green Talents 2013 studied their International Forum for High Potentials in Sustainable Development on October 28th. Some 430 scholars were invited to this year's competition to share their experiences during a two-week workshop. Organized by the German Federal Ministry of Education and Research, the Green Talents Award, as an incentive for cross-cultural exchange, is one of the goals of the ministry to ensure international progress towards sustainability. Welcome back. Today, the book I'm going to introduce you to is titled Journey of the Unseen World, written by Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Najafi. This book attempts to draw a picture of the barzakh, that is, I guess they call it in English, the limbo, in the light of the Quran and the traditions of the Prophet and his successors. It shows the bliss of the virtuous and the wretchedness of the evildoers with the help of examples and hints taken from the verses and the traditions. Some of the chapters of the book are The Station of the Grave and the Beginning of Barzakh, Journey to the First Station, Journey Towards the Second Station, Journey Towards the Third Station, the Fourth Station, and Reunion with Hadi, Travel to the Next Station with Hadi, The Station of Bliss and Peace, The Last Station, The Valley of Peace, Spring in Valley of Peace, and finally, A Visit to Hell. Hope you will like it. Well, in our previous programs, we had Dr. Fadimi providing the best answers to psychological questions, and a couple of our viewers have sent us emails acknowledging and appreciating Dr. Fadimi for his wonderful discussions, as they say. Wonderful discussion. I took a class with him at Harvard. Great speaker, very knowledgeable. Unfortunately, we don't know the name of this viewer. And the second person has written to us, I really enjoyed this. Please have more of these excellent discussions. That's what people need. I absolutely agree with you. The psychological issues, especially from the viewpoint of religion and Islam in particular, are what people right now need at this point of our life. Well, that's it for this edition. Back to you, Ms. Arju.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bafoju. Now, we have a report in this part of the program, and it's an exhibit displayed by women who are juggling work outside and inside the home. And just to have something new, I think they got creative, and here's their art exhibit. Let's take a look.
I am Sharore Khanipur. I have studied medical laboratory science. At present, I work in Pasteur Institute of Iran together with my husband. In fact, We are co-workers. I both work out of home and do the household task at home. I also have a son. When life becomes monotonous, after a while, one feels that there needs to be a kind of variety in life. For the same reason, I decided to learn an art. The art I was interested in was painting. So I went to one of my friends who is a professional in this field and started to learn painting 3 years ago. My classmates and I decided to hold a joint exhibition. We are in the exhibition now. I am very happy that I have started to learn painting, and I regret why I didn't start to learn an art earlier. Being an artist has improved my spirits at home and has made me more determined to continue my job. I also thank my husband for cooperating with me, because when a person wants to do something besides his or her duties at home and at work, he or she needs someone's cooperation.
In the name of God, I am Hamid Reza Safati. This gallery was established 10 years ago by my wife, and I cooperate with her. Although my professional expertise is quite different, I've gotten interested in painting. We have had various exhibitions in this gallery. Besides holding exhibitions, we teach painting here. Many of our learners are housewives, and some of them even work out of home. The current exhibition is the joint exhibition of a number of female artists who have tried to use their artistic talents in addition to doing the household tasks and working out of home. And the result is the paintings you see here. In the name of God, I have come to visit this exhibition together with my son. This is a very interesting exhibition because it includes paintings of different styles. A number of women have used their artistic talents in addition to performing their duties at home and taking care of their children and husbands, as well as working out of home and performing their social roles. The result is the paintings you see here.
Welcome back to the program. Well, we have our final minutes of the program ahead of us, and we want to wrap up. Unfortunately, we can't talk about revising the attachment styles because we don't have enough time, but we would like to continue this discussion with Dr. Fatemi next week. To end off, we just want to talk a little bit more about the components of intersubjectivity, and then, of course, we will continue with attachment and its implications next week again.
Sure. So. When we focus on intersubjectivity and we want to find out what is it that is going to proceed with intersubjectivity, we can focus on a number of components. One of them is the concept of safety and the concept of exploration. The child needs to feel and experience that sort of safe abode right at the beginning. If he or she does not have that sense of experiential connectedness to the safety and security, she won't be able to explore. So you need to help the child experience that sense of safety, that sense of everything is going to be fine here, nothing is going to be menacing, nothing is going to be pernicious, nothing is going to threaten your self-esteem, your understanding, etc. So that safety, that feeling of safety is going to be associated with, now I can explore and find out, you know, multiple perspectives, mm-hmm. you know, various aspects of the objects, you know, understanding the world in a tangible, concrete manner, so that I can get that sense of connectedness. So phenomenologically, that playfulness is going to arise out of that sense of safety followed by exploration. The point is that caregivers are not going to provide the child with that sense of exploration if they already have not provided him or her with that sense of safety. Mm-hmm. So safety is the big factor, is the bottom line. Mm-hmm. As long as we have not established that sense of safety, that sense of security, and the child experiences, for example, fear, trepidation, anxiety, the child is not going to be fully experiencing the world. So he's not able to be in touch with the world as he or she should. Mm-hmm. And exploration is an important part of curiosity that is going to be also associated with intersubjectivity, that you and I are going to be curious, are going to experience the world, mm-hmm. our interaction, our correspondence, our communication, all of them are going to be subsumed under that category so that we get that sense of togetherness, that sense of, well, I'm here for you and you're here for me, and that sense of togetherness is going to develop that sense of rapture. But unfortunately, a lot of caregivers, because of not paying attention, they do not give that sense of rapture, they give that sense of rupture, mm-hmm. in the sense of, you know, they sever the ties. Mm-hmm. They sever the ties in the sense that that severance, that sort of blockage, is going to provide, you know, the child with more potential fear. And that fear is going to have an impact on the child's communication. We just need to remember that communication is being affected and also affecting the quality of that togetherness. Mm-hmm. So it is of great significance to understand how that exploration can be connected and can be linked to that sense of safety. And it all goes back and emanates from that sense of, do I have security inside myself? Mm-hmm. If I haven't got that security inside myself, if I haven't got that sense of safety, if I haven't got that sense of confidence, how could I ever give that sense of
confidence,
you know, to the child? Mm-hmm. So it is incumbent upon the parents to get that sense of, you know, confidence, that sense of composure, that sense of comfort, because if you're rife with that perturbability, how could you ever give that to people?
All right. Okay, well, it's a very important topic, as we were saying in the break, that this is something that will be engraved within your child to go on and for their life ahead. So it's definitely something we will discuss. So tune in next week to hear about this again with Dr. Fatemi. Thanks so much for tuning in. Don't forget, go on our website and check us out, sahartv.ir, and drop us a line. peerhome@sahartv.ir is our address, our email address. Thank you so much for inviting us into your peer home. Until next time, goodbye and God bless.